Well, if you brought a Bible this morning, would you open it to the book of Acts, chapter 17? And as we pick up our story this morning, we find the Apostle Paul alone in the great city of Athens. Because of conflict and Jewish opposition, he had left Berea, and he was accompanied by some unnamed believers, and they take him all the way to the coast and put him on a boat and safely escort him the 300-mile trip by sea down to Athens. And then they return home with the instructions to send Silas and Timothy as soon as possible. So Paul's alone in Athens. And although Athens was no longer the politically important city it once was, having been conquered by Rome in 146 BC, it was still the intellectual center of the world. It was the heir to all the great philosophers of the world, men like Socrates, Plato, Epicurus, Zeno, Pericles, men who have established patterns of thought that have affected human learning for centuries. And there's something enthralling about the Apostle Paul in Athens, the great Christian apostle amid the glories of ancient Greece. Of course, he must have known about Athens since his boyhood. Everyone did. And now he visits for the first time the city which he'd heard so much about. He's alone in the cultural center of the world. And we wonder what his reaction will be to the city. And Luke records for us in the passage we're going to look at today, Paul's reaction. He tells us what he saw, what he felt, what he did, what he said. And as we go through his passage, it's going to give us great insight into our own response in visiting or living in a city that is intellectually and culturally sophisticated, but morally decadent and spiritually dead. And it'll prepare us for celebrating the Lord's table in a few minutes. So we pick up the story in verse 16 of Acts chapter 17. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, that is Timothy and Silas, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. So Luke tells us that Paul was waiting in Athens for Timothy and Silas to arrive. Athens wasn't on his agenda for the trip, and he's apparently not planning to stay long. And as he waited for them in the city, he did what you and I would do. He did a little sightseeing. And as he wandered among the buildings and statues and altars, I'm sure he appreciated the beauty of this magnificent city. He was a man of culture. Athens was an unbelievably beautiful place. The Acropolis, the Parthenon, one of the architectural wonders of this world. To this day, stunning. Magnificently stunning to the human eye. That word observing is the word from which we get our word theater from. He looked long and hard at what he saw. And what Paul saw, Luke tells us, was a city full of idols. The city of Athens was crammed with altars and images and statues to other gods. Some historians write that it was easier to find a god in Athens than a man. And statistically, that may be true. The population of Athens at the time was about 10,000, but some scholars estimate there may have been as many as 30,000 statues of gods in the city. And because of what he saw, Luke tells us how he felt. his spirit was being provoked, or as the NIV puts it, he was greatly distressed. He was very upset. He was angry. He wasn't angry at the people or even at the idolatry per se. It was what idolatry does to people that troubled him. He saw the emptiness in their lives as they believed those lies. He saw all the beauty, this city, the culture, and the art. And on the surface, everything looked good. But Paul saw more than that. Because he knew that under the surface, things weren't good at all. And that's the way we need to look at secular society as well. We need to see our world the way Paul saw his. We'll talk more about that when we reflect on this text in a few minutes. So Luke tells us Paul felt compelled to discuss the matter. He began dialoguing with anyone who would talk. He went first, as he always did, to the Jews and the God-fearers in the synagogue. But there didn't seem to be much response there, so he took his message out into the streets. He went into the marketplace and he began to talk to people there where the need was. The Agora was just a couple blocks northwest of the Acropolis. It was the center of social and commercial and intellectual life in those days. There was a marketplace with stalls for the sale of fruit and vegetables, and interspersed with the stalls were altars and images and statues of various types and temples, some of which have been reconstructed and are there today. And around the outside of the marketplace were a series of covered porches or porticos called stoas, where philosophers would teach. And so there was this circus atmosphere with people milling and about, buying and selling, politicians stumping, philosophers debating with one another. So right in the midst of this atmosphere, Paul evidently got out his soapbox and began to preach. Or maybe he engaged one of the philosophers in a debate, but it didn't take long before there was a response. Verse 18. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" Others, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is in which you're proclaiming? For you're bringing some strange things to our ears. So we want to know what these things mean." And Luke adds a little side note here. Now, all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. Luke tells us before long, he confronted the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers there in the marketplace. These two groups of philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics, represented the two competing philosophies of the day. The Epicureans based their philosophy on the teachings of a man named Epicurus, who had lived about 300 years before Paul was in Athens. Today, when we think of an Epicurean, we think of somebody who likes good food. But in that day, their philosophy was a little more complex. They were agnostic. They didn't know if the gods existed or not. And if they did, they lived very far off and had absolutely nothing to do with the world. They believed everything happened by chance. The gods were not in control of anything. And the end of life was simply death. Extinction with no afterlife. So their philosophy was, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. They believed that you better go for all the gusto you can, because you're only going to go around once in life. The other group were called Stoics because their teacher Zeno taught in these stoas, these porches, and they gained their name from that location. They were just the opposite of the Epicureans. They believed the gods controlled everything. Everything was fated and fixed. Life was grim and harsh because the gods were cruel and uncaring. So the best you can do in life is to grin and bear it. Life was lived with apathy and detachment. Our word stoic has come over into the English meaning just that. Vince Lombardi's famous saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, at the core is stoicism at its root core. And these were the competing and conflicting philosophies that Paul encountered. And if you think about it, if you don't have God in your life, those are the two major options to choose from. Either you decide to make pleasure your ultimate good and decide to go for all the gusto, or you decide that life is tough and you just got to be tougher. And both of those philosophies engender a sort of pride. Epicureans have the pride of pleasure. They take pride in how much alcohol they can hold or how many sexual conquests they've had. On the other hand, Stoics take pride in their character, how tough they are, how much they can endure. And so these are bright, intelligent people, well-read, very sophisticated. They heard Paul preach about Jesus and the resurrection, and they respond with a kind of clever, ironic sarcasm. They remark, "What is this seed picker trying to say?" That's exactly what the word translated idle babbler means, literally. Seed pickers were little sparrows that hopped around in the marketplace picking up scraps of seed and grain. And that's how they thought of Paul. He didn't seem to be very polished. His message didn't seem very well thought through. He sounded like he was just simply sharing some eclectic hodgepodge information. And they made fun of him. They wrote him off. But Luke tells us some of them took him and brought him to the Areopagus. The Areopagus was sort of a philosophical debating society that didn't have any legal authority, but they were the champions of morals and religions in the city of Athens. They loved to debate. They were called the Areopagi because they met on a little hill. You can see that hill behind me. The word simply means the hill of the Ares or Mars Hill. It's a little outcropping of rock just a little northwest of the Parthenon where these philosophers met to debate. It was a very prestigious body of men. There were about 50 of them, and they were the scholars of this day. And they bring Paul into the group and they ask him, "We want to know this teaching you're proclaiming." And then Luke adds that footnote. Now, all the Athenians and strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing more than telling or hearing something new. Literally, it reads new word. They'd heard it all. Athens was the city of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and Zeno and Epicurus. And they had heard every conceivable philosophy. And they were given to novelty. They always wanted to hear something newer, which tells us something of their quest. They were looking for something. With all of their wisdom, they hadn't found what they were looking for. So Paul stands up to speak. I want you to put yourself in his place. Here are the scholars of the world at the time, and you're about ready to address them. I'm sure the adrenaline was flowing and he was praying. Verse 22. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you're very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects to your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." Now, in the book of Acts, Luke's recorded three samples of the Apostle Paul's teaching. In Acts 13, there's a sample of his teaching in a synagogue to Jews. In Acts 20, we have an example of his preaching to believers at a church in Ephesus. And here in Acts 17, we have an example of his preaching to non-Christians. It certainly is a summary. Paul must have said more than this. So this is probably a shorthand account of what he said. And his point of contact is their idolatry. Men of Athens, I observe you're very religious in all respects. You are given to spiritual things, he tells them. Remember, the city's crammed with altars and images and statues to other gods. He doesn't start by attacking their idolatry, but by admiring their search. Because when you forego the God of the universe, it takes an infinite number of gods to fill his place. They looked everywhere for some God to satisfy them, but in spite of their search, they're empty. But notice how Paul argues. He says the real evidence of their hunger for spiritual things is not the fact that they have many gods, but that they had one particular altar to an unknown God. Notice the conjunction for at the beginning of verse 23. It was the existence of this one altar that indicated to Paul the depth of their search. They tried to find God everywhere, and they finally gave up, made an altar to an unknown God. You see, they thought that if the gods weren't properly venerated, they could strike your city. So lest they offend a god in their ignorance of him, they built numerous altars to unknown gods. And Paul tells them, what is unknown to you, I'm going to declare. And so Paul introduces his God to the Athenians. Verse 24. The God who made all the world, the God who made the world and all the things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Maybe he pointed up to the Parthenon, which is only 200 yards away from where he was. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. He begins with the fundamental truth that God is the creator of the universe. That would be very different. It would be very different understanding than the Epicureans would have of some chance combination of atoms or the pantheism of the Stoics. He denies the premise of both groups. God is the personal creator of everything and the personal Lord of everything he has made. Secondly, he not only created everything, he's the sustainer of all life. And with these words, he speaks to the very heart of pagan worship. He tells them God is not served by human hands. This endless routine of propitiating gods by offering up bloody sacrifices is fruitless. He's not impressed by efforts to propitiate him. He doesn't need to be satisfied. He's already satisfied. That's his point. He cares about you. Most pagan religions are designed to get God to care about people. Paul says you don't have to do that. He already cares about you. You don't have to give him anything. He's the giver of every good and perfect gift. It's absurd, therefore, to suppose that he who sustains life should need to be sustained. That he who supplies our need should need our supply. And so many of us who've grown up in severely dysfunctional homes have such a distorted concept of God that it keeps us from truly knowing God. We think of him as harsh and cruel and demanding. And we need to understand, as these Athenians needed to understand, that God loved them. And he wanted to give. Next, Paul tells them that God is the ruler of every nation. Verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him, though He is not far from each one of us. Now, if your only understanding of history is from your education in high school or college, then you might think that what drives history is economics. That's what I was taught. Or war. Or great men. Paul reminds us that God is sovereign and He is shaping history for His redemptive purposes. As someone has said, history is His story. And His sovereignty is over every nation that ever existed, which includes evil powers as well. All the Idi Amins and the Hitlers, Saddam Husseins. He determines a nation's existence, boundaries, and power. He doesn't accept responsibility for their evil, but He permits their existence for a purpose. He has a greater purpose than freedom and liberty. The greater purpose is redemption. See what Paul's saying? He's determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitations so that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him. The restrictions that are placed on us as peoples are there that we might seek God. They are to drive us to the end of ourselves that we might, as Paul says, grope for God. That word grope denotes the groping and fumbling of a blind person. God desires that we seek Him. That's why He allows catastrophes to occur. That's why wars break out. That's why violence occurs. God allows evil in men's hearts to break out in these terrible catastrophes, these tremendously difficult events, in order to show men that they're not independent. That it is a self-delusion to think that you can live without God. And I'm sure there are people here this morning who could stand up and testify, if you had opportunity, that you lived for years with this idolatrous delusion that you were sufficient in yourself, until something occurred in your life that put you flat on your back or broke your heart. Something came crashing in, some great disappointment, and made you realize for the first time that you can't live without God. That's the purpose of history. He continues. Verse 28. For in Him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said. For we also are His children. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because He has fixed the day in which He will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom He has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising Him from the dead. Now, Paul could have quoted Scripture to support this thought of the nearness of God. He could have quoted Deuteronomy, as he did in the letter to the Romans, saying He's very near to us. But he doesn't. Instead, he quotes two Greek poets. The first part of the verse, "For in him we live and move and exist," is from the work of Epimenides. And the final line in verse 28, "For we also are his children," comes from the writings of a poet named Aratus. The whole line reads like this: "All ways are full of Zeus and all meaning places of men. The sea and the harbors are full of them. In every direction, we all have to do with Zeus, for we also are his children." Zeus was the high god in the Greek pantheon of gods. And Paul is basically saying to them, Zeus is very near. Doesn't bother to even change the name. And I'm impressed how well-read Paul is. He read what people in society were writing. He understood people who lived in this world. He's able to argue biblical truth from their literature. And he's talking here about the character and nature of man. He's saying man is created in the image of God. Man moves and lives and exists. Therefore, God moves and lives and exists. Therefore, how absurd it is to try to represent God through pieces of wood or stone. It's ridiculous, he says. Think it through. Idolatry not only degrades God, it degrades man. Idolatry says we can be satisfied by things that are much less than who we are. It's a lie, Paul says. Therefore, Paul says, we are to repent of our idolatry because there's coming an inescapable day that's ahead. God has fixed a day when he will judge the world. Judgment is coming. That sense of that nagging feeling that I find is inside most every human being, that someday there's going to be a comeuppance. Someday I'm going to have an accounting of my life to God. Paul says that judgment is not going to come from some remote God on Mount Olympus, but from a man. A man who has been raised from the dead. And I think at this point, Paul wanted to go on and preach about Jesus, his life and death and burial and resurrection. But when he mentioned the resurrection, the place came unglued. Verse 32. "Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer. And others said, 'We shall hear you again concerning this.' So Paul went out of their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them." So Paul's sermon, abrupted, stopped as it was, has three results: mockery, delay, and belief. Some scoffed, scorned. It's just a seed picker. What a waste of time. Some were polite but indecisive. "Why don't you come back another time? We'd like to hear you again." Like most people, politely indecisive, always learning, never coming to the knowledge of the truth. But a few believed. In fact, one of the scholars, Dionysius, believed, and a woman named Damaris and a few others. And so Paul left a very small group of believers of whom we know nothing about. Paul never wrote a letter to this church. We don't have a first and second Athenians. We don't know what happened. So let me close quickly and prepare us to share the Lord's table together by sharing some reflections. Let me share with you three reflections I have from this text. First, I think we need to ask God to help us see others the way He sees them. We need to learn to see past people's behavior to the need that that behavior reveals. We often respond incorrectly to people because we don't see clearly. Despite what people are often inclined to show us up front, down deep inside most people, they're looking for something. They might call it God, or they might not They might not even realize it's a spiritual quest. They just realize that there must be something more to life than this. There's an itch inside them they can't scratch. As the writer to the book of Ecclesiastes reminds us, God has placed eternity in the hearts of men. There's a hunger inside each one of us that no startup can satisfy. No man or woman can satisfy. No child can satisfy. Nothing in this life, no material thing can satisfy that inward yearning. We live in a culture of beautiful people who are bright. They dress with beautiful cars. They dress with beautiful clothes. They don't dress with beautiful cars. They drive beautiful cars. They live in beautiful homes. Take vacation in beautiful places. And we often look at their lives incorrectly and respond wrongly. We look at that and we're envious. And we want it. We read People magazine, you know, and we see the way they eat and where they go and what they do. And it looks so attractive. And we want to be like them. And what we don't see is that often down below, where we can't see, is an emptiness. And a quest for something deeper, more meaningful. That's what Paul saw. That's what Paul saw. Will you remember that today, tomorrow morning, when you look across the street and see your neighbor who looks like he has it all together? Or your associate at work who dresses so nice and looks so cool? That they seem to have no needs. Often there's deep, deep, deep needs. Secondly, I think this passage reminds us that we need to be in the world. And we need to know the world. Jesus was a friend of sinners, and we need to be acquainted with people in secular society. We need to be where people are, in the marketplace. We need to build relationships there. We need to make proclamation there. We need to understand how people think. It appears to me that Paul read the Greek classics. He's a student of secular society. He wasn't afraid of secular facts. He recognized truth wherever he found it. And he was bold in his proclamation of truth. Right there in the marketplace. That's where we need to be. Not huddled together in our own safe little world. We need to be there where people are. And then finally, just let me say that regardless of the reaction we get from non-Christians, we need to be gracious and loving and courteous. We need to treat people with dignity and respect. I'm impressed by how Paul responded with kindness and courtesy to scoffing and criticism. He could have just lashed out at them, right? He could have just said, "You are a bunch of idol-worshipping pagans, and you're all going to hell. So let me just say goodbye to you before you go." He didn't respond that way at all. Like God, he overlooked their ignorance. He was patient. He saw past their behavior to the needs that the behavior represented. So he spoke to their need, to their quest, to their deep desires within. He attempted to build a rapport with them. very patient. What a great model. That's what our world needs as well.